Medical Matters.
16 minutes after 8, and I'm joined by Professor Renata Schoeman, head of the MBA in Healthcare Leadership at Stellenbosch Business School. Prof, thank you so much for joining us. So great to talk to you again.
Good evening, Audrey. Good evening, listeners.
So what is World Health Day all about? And obviously it would have taken place yesterday. What is it all about?
So World Health Day is an annual celebration with different themes, but most of it is regarding access to healthcare. And this year, once again, it was the right to health. Now, it's often a misrepresentation what is a right and what is a value, and I think that is part of what we're going to discuss. But it really aims at bringing more health to more communities right across the world.
Yeah. So it's the idea that we need to make health as accessible as possible to as many people as possible, I imagine, Prof?
Yes, but that's maybe where the terminology is a bit of a misnomer or misleading.
Yep.
Because access to healthcare do not promise you health. So I would like to challenge the view that health is a right. It's access to healthcare that's a right. But health is a personal and social value, and everyone should have and should take personal responsibility for it.
And so what are the issues? I mean, what are the contentious issues that sort of spark this debate? I mean, at first I thought Professor Schoeman is just being pedantic with language here. But I actually get what you're saying, that there's a right to health and then there's a right to health care. And those two ideas are actually quite different.
Yes, if we see health as a human right, then it can make us passive recipients and disempower us to take an active role in our health journey. Health is not something that a government can provide or any care system can provide. Health is partly genetics, partly just luck, I suppose, but also very much to do with lifestyle and choices, personal choices. So if we confuse health care with health, and as I mentioned, having access to care is not a promise of health, then we are really disempowered. And the only thing that something like universal health insurance can ensure is improving funding to promote accessibility. But we cannot view a healthcare system as the answer to a healthier society.
And is that really the issue here, at least in the context of South Africa? I mean, we know that that bill is sitting on the president's desk waiting for a signature. Is that the issue as far as the South African sort of permutation of this conversation is about, the issue of the NHI?
There's a few things. I think, number one, we have really made good strides in South Africa in terms of health of the nation over the past couple of decades. We're an absolute success story in terms of HIV in the world. And the death rate in South Africa has decreased over the past decades, but the number of deaths due to non-communicable diseases, such as diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and cancer, is on the rise. Now, partly it's because of longevity. We're living longer, and we're getting older, and older people are facing different type of illnesses than younger people. But one of the big problems is that we have an extreme rise in diabetes. So if we look at the figures, in 2010, about 4.5% of the population had diabetes, and now we in 2019 already, it was lying at almost 13%. That means like almost 5 million South Africans between 20 and 80 years are estimated to have diabetes, but only about 50% are diagnosed. So we are not even aware that we are walking around with illness that can cause other comorbidities and even complications such as death. Now, so that is the one aspect, that our patient profile, the population profile, has changed, but we do not think only in terms of prevention of that. So promotion of health and prevention of sickness is where we should focus. Healthcare is also a little bit of a misnomer, because if you think in terms of what the healthcare system is about, it's for caring for the sick. So it's sick care. We should promote health and prevent people from even becoming ill. And if they do become ill, to pick up illnesses very, very early in terms of screening. The third thing here is that no one will contest that universal health insurance is a great idea and a great ideal. I mean, it should just be just that everyone has access to good health services, physical and mental health services. The problem is the NHI, or the bill as it is currently, the legislation proposed, only look at the funding, and it doesn't look at the reform of the system, the resources, how this will actually be delivered. So it's only about where are we going to get the money from, and currently they want to move money from one functional aspect of the health system, if I can put it that way, to another part. And we've seen in the past what happens if we pooled finances and the wrong hands have access to it. It just disappears. But secondly is we need to reform the services. Mm. And also in terms of funding, you know, even in countries like the UK, where there's a large proportion of taxpayers, or the Scandinavian countries, where there's a 73% of the population of taxpayers, in South Africa, our situation looks significantly different. So if you only depend on taxpayers to fund it, it's virtually not sustainable. And that is where the personal responsibility in terms of health and promoting health and wellness comes in. That is far more sustainable, keeping a society healthy, than trying to care for them when they're sick.
So if I understand you correctly, and again, I'm still sticking with the conversation around the issues pertaining to World Health Day as far as South Africa is concerned, you're concerned that we may be conflating the issues if we don't really look at the meanings of the words we use to describe certain phenomena in the health sector. But more importantly, you're concerned that we could be in a situation where we are simply transferring money from one pool to another, without actually doing the required reforms to make the sick care business in South Africa a lot more effective.
Absolutely. If you think that if we just move the pool of money around, how is that going to change the access to healthcare for someone that sits really, really in a rural area? If there isn't a clinic, or at least a mobile clinic, if there's not a nurse or a community worker, if there's not a medical doctor. This year alone, there was 800 community service doctors. So that year after you qualify with your degree as a doctor, where you have to work for the government, 800 doctors that didn't have positions. At this stage, only about 250 have been placed. So here are 550 doctors that do not have work because the government can't pay their salaries. So where will they go? So what we have is the exodus of doctors as well, and especially the younger people. If you do not promise health practitioners sustainability as well, it is very, very difficult, because now you reform the system, but you've only reformed the financial aspect of it. You haven't really reformed the sources. And there's a big call from different stakeholders operating within the healthcare system, or the broader healthcare system, and then I'm talking about private, public, and the NGO space, that perhaps we should first look at improving efficiency in the public sector, and then also look at some decentralization of certain services and then move towards value-based healthcare, which is a different discussion. But there's a lot of international reform where we are only focused absolutely on a financial aspect of it, which is really only the tip of the iceberg.
What should we be focusing on in terms of, and my question to you is the understanding not that if we have the NHI program ignited, that that's what it means, that the reforms that you speak of will in fact be undertaken? Is that not the understanding?
Not well, that is, I suppose, what is being sold to the public. But it can't, because it won't make you healthier. It will only help you when you're sick. And that's where we come back to our focus should be on the health as a personal and social value, rather than only the right, because then we have people investing in their health. If we could all reduce the strain on the system, there will already be more money available to care for people when they need it. If we look at a more collaborative approach and also address the social determinants of health, for example, the social and economic factors such as poverty, unemployment, housing, and education and capital letters, nutrition, and then also having a healthy and safe environment where you can be active and not subjected to pollution, etc., and other contaminants. And then finally, your personal choices. Then your chance of staying healthy and not having to access sick care is much better.
I hear the argument. Philosophically, I hear the argument. I'm just trying to understand, how do we then promote greater health that we don't have to struggle with the accessing of sick care? But I also want to address the South African elephant in the room as far as the whole argument about NHI is concerned. I mean, you've heard the arguments and you've probably thought about them a little harder than I have, Prof, that the NHI is an attempt to try and de-racialize the health sector. In other words, de-racialize it in the sense that as things are at the moment, the healthy health sector is that which is financed by private money, and that would include medical aids and so forth. But that privilege is afforded mostly by the middle class, who are mostly white. And that is a legacy of our past. And that the health sector that is failing, which is the public health sector, which is what most poor people, who are mostly black, are having to contend with when they have to access sick care, to use your words. How do we deal with those issues? Because I imagine that the politicians will speak in those terms.
Okay. Let me start with maybe giving you some good news statistics.
Yep.
So firstly, if we look at the healthcare index by country for 2024, so this is brand new data, we are currently lying at number 49 out of 94 countries that participated. And the healthcare index look at the estimation of that evaluates the overall quality of healthcare system. It looks at healthcare professionals, equipment, staff, doctors, and cost. And it looks at an assessment of the healthcare infrastructure, services, and resources in a location. Now, this is a good indication that we're not doing bad. It takes into account both public and private sector. Mm. Now, Cape Town stands at the forefront with the most robust healthcare system in Africa, following closely by Pretoria and then Nairobi. Now, yes, it's urban areas. So my concern is rural versus urban accessibility. The second thing that we need to look at, part of the problems in South Africa, yes, we can, but I want to come to your argument. I just want to create some context first. If we have an increased life expectancy, that's good. That means the public sector also did what it should be doing. People are living longer. We have increased incidence of non-communicable diseases. As I mentioned, that is bad, but it's because we live longer. But there's an upward trend in health spending, and the spending is in the public sector, but also in the private sector. But in the public sector, the spending is driven by inefficiencies, where maybe in parts of the private sector, certain sectors that might be slightly over-servicing of population and unnecessary hospitalizations. That I'm definitely aware of as well. But the current mode of the system no longer fit the purpose. If we look at, as I mentioned, the communicable diseases that decreased, what is our big problem is that South Africa's healthcare budget has increased at an average of 2.5% per year over the past couple of years. But the public sector spending, on healthcare jumped also about 3,800 rand from over the past 20 years. So it's very, very tiny, but it's more than double. It was 2,000 rand per capita roughly in 1995, and it's now at almost 6,000 rand. We do see that the National Department of Health have a decline in terms of the budget spent towards healthcare. So now we have the National Health Department that invests less in the public sector. They spend about 64 billion rand in 2022-23, and now it's 60 billion for 2023 to 2024.
Yep.
So that is one of the reasons why we do not see, it's not necessarily that there's more spent private, it's relatively less spent public. Then there is statistics, and damned statistics. And what politicians love to quote is that 84% of the population make use of the public sector and 16% of the private sector. Now, we must remember that of that, 50% of all spend is government funded and 50% is private funded. But government funding comes from tax, and it's private sector people that's taxed. So there's 3 million taxpayers in the country that's currently paying 100% of the health budget, directly or indirectly, and the health spend. And that statistics is often distorted. It's proclaimed or portrayed that 16% of the population is spending the whole budget. But that 16% of the population is funding themselves, and they are funding a huge different portion of the public. Coming back to where my bigger concern is actually the discrepancies between rural and urban areas. That is a bigger discrepancy. If we look at people belonging to private funders, the racial diversity has increased significantly. I mean, if you looked 30 years ago, it was mainly, as you mentioned, more affluent white people belonging to medical schemes. That is way, way, way more diverse now. So we can't just make that blanket statement anymore. But is there inequalities? Yes. Will only a universal health cover reach sort this? Definitely not.
So the priority, at least as South Africa is concerned, should be creating greater sick care access in the rural areas, if I understand you correctly.
I think there's two things. There should be a two-pronged approach. We should have a bigger focus on promoting health and well-being. So we want to prevent disease and injury before it occurs, and we can talk about different strategies that have been proposed and has been implemented already. Secondary prevention, that is where sick care starts. Secondary prevention is to reduce the impact of disease when it's already occurred. So if I develop breast cancer, it must be diagnosed very, very early so that I can get treatment, or a pap smear for cervix cancer or whatever. I want screening tests. I want my blood pressure at least twice a year monitored. But for that, I need a sister or a clinic that can check it for me. You know, so we can do that screening early to identify disease. And then tertiary prevention is where we really are patient, and now we want to be back at work as quick as possible and as healthy as possible. And then the second aspect is then once I'm ill, that's where I need easy and accessible health care or sick care.
And you're saying that at this stage, we don't see the back office arrangement of the NHI to suit those particular needs, except the movement of funds, basically.
Yeah, zero. If you read through the document or the bill, there is nothing that states how the services will be rendered. We are clueless as healthcare professionals. There's some indications that they first want to do it in the primary health, so primary healthcare, like more GP clinic type of reform, but we have no idea what they are going to do. There's a lot of speculations. There's a lot of, I want to say, threats about how we're going to do it, that they want to reintroduce the certificate of need so you can only work as a doctor where they want to put you, and that is the last thing we can afford. We will have an exodus of doctor because that is against human rights of freedom of movement and freedom to work and stay where I want to stay. So it's really against our own, you know, our own constitution if they start implementing things like that. But if we reverse a little bit, look at what is happening in South Africa that is good in terms of promotion of health. The government has been good at implementing disincentives to unhealthy lifestyles, such as the sin taxes on alcohol and sugary drinks, etc. And hopefully they will implement similar things on junk food. But then in the private sector, we have very good incentive programs, such as discounts and loyalty rewards for exercise and healthy food.
Yes.
Now, that is something that we should extend to the public sector, because it will be more affordable than the NHI. But it will take some innovation and some collaboration, because if you want to think that we need to be able in the public sector to have discounts and loyalty rewards for exercise and healthy food, firstly, that food needs to be available. secondly, the places to exercise need to be available. It's very easy to say you need to exercise 5 times a week, 30 minutes, but if your neighborhood is unsafe, how do you need to go for a walk or a run, or where's your gym? So why don't we provide that? And then also something that could potentially work, if there's healthy food and food choices are also being subsidized by the government, and not only the bare necessities, but there are more incentives. And I believe that the corporate sector can also play a role here. If you look at most organizations, I don't know what is the situation in your office building, but there's most likely a vending machine with chocolates and chips and sugary drinks. I have not seen a vending machine with fresh fruit. I have not seen a fruit bowl standing around. So I know that there is some organizations that do have some kind of one meal a day. But that's, for example, a place where the public and the private sector can take hands. You know, what about I provide my employees with at least one well-balanced, nutritious meal that I could get subsidy from? I don't think there's any organization that would decline such a partnership with the public sector. And then obviously we need to look also that, as I said, we need to entrench health and health promotion as a shared social value. And it starts at families, at schools, and specifically also the role of the media. You have such a powerful tool and such an important tool of educating and giving information. And this is the way that we can really help people to start to think differently about their own health journey and what I can do. Because I think most of us will agree, if I never have to see a doctor, that would be my first choice.
Sure.
If I never have a problem. So what can I do, even from safe driving and avoiding alcohol or whatever the case might be? If I don't need to go to a doctor or hospital, I would be the happiest.
Okay. So in as far as World Health Day, those are the issues that we should be considering in our conversations about the health system, the sick care system in South Africa. That should be the conversation that we should be encouraging, so that people are aware of some of these issues that you've raised this evening. Globally, what are the issues as far as world care is concerned? What are the issues that the world is contending with?
I think the biggest problem across the board, especially in the more developed nations, is the aging population. If we see the skew demographic where the elderly patients are really, or elderly people are completely dominating the demographic pyramids. And that put a significant strain also on non-communicable diseases. Now, some of the very advanced countries have made strides in terms of the use of technology in providing services, whether it is care bots for the elderly, etc. However, in vast parts of the world still, and especially in Africa, I've recently attended another congress where I was the only person from Africa, and I was challenging them to say, but you are ignoring 18% of the world's population. Yeah. We are in Africa. Our challenges are different. We have a young population. We're still struggling with access to basic sanitation and housing, and we struggle with unemployment and poverty and poor education. If we don't address this social determinants of health, that is where there's a problem. The third big thing that's on the agenda is the rise of mental health-related disorders, especially stress-related disorders. And then just coming back closer to home is South Africa has recently been found to be the most internet-addicted country in the world. So that is some of the global problems, also the impact. And then there's also positive movements in terms of, especially during COVID, where I think if we can find a positive of COVID was the increased awareness on mental health, yeah, and also the use of e-medicine and telemedicine. And that is still a big movement, which is a big positive. And then there is still also, obviously, a big part of the population that struggles with the aftermaths of COVID.
Shall we, you talk of COVID. One of the things that I often talk about is the fact that we probably haven't yet understood the full impact of COVID socially, economically, because of the fact that it really impacted global economic realities in ways that I still think we're figuring out. But do you think that we've come to the end of the COVID story as far as health is concerned, as far as physiological, biological health is concerned? I mean, hear this thing. It started. It gave us all a big fright. Some of us nearly died. Some of us did die. And then suddenly it's gone. Are we done with COVID and things like COVID?
It's actually not done. We recently had another surge and another wave of COVID infections. It was, 2 months ago? But the difference is it's now what they call endemic. It's not a pandemic anymore. So we all get it now like a common flu. Yes. We maybe have different type of symptoms, but we will die from other type of infections, not COVID per se. But it's now part of our lives, like flu or whatever. And still there's people that's more vulnerable, and we should continue with the good habits we had in COVID. We see an increase in childhood diseases again. We see an increase in people having common cold and flus, people that have gastrointestinal diseases, because we stopped washing our hands. It was the best habit ever. The pharmaceutical companies hated it. I'm saying that a little bit tongue in the cheek, but the use of antibiotics during the COVID period declined significantly because we had better personal hygiene. And that is the things that we should remember. Why didn't we get ill? Those that of us that didn't have COVID, I wasn't so lucky. I also was one of those that had COVID, but the people that didn't get ill was some of the good habits we had was wearing masks, having good ventilation in rooms, not hugging and kissing everyone, you know, strangers and stuff. And we maybe should just remind ourselves of that common sense basic hygiene principles that keep us healthy. In terms of the mental health aftermath, I don't think we've seen the full repercussions yet. People struggled financially, socially, and whatever during COVID. And there was a lot of human loss, as you mentioned, and financial loss. But I find now, and we're now basically 2 years post the pandemic or all the lockdown stuff, people are taking more emotional strain now.
Yes.
Adults, because they could never recover financially. People that had to work from home and now they struggle to transition back to working at the office, or those that are still working at home and just experience severe social isolation. And then the saddest for me is our young population. The impact that COVID had on the school children, both in the primary school and foundation phase, but also even in secondary school, they really struggle with the normal identity information that teenagers should have, that they didn't have the social interaction, they're less resilient. Children missed out on 2 years of schooling, especially in the less privileged areas where they couldn't pivot to online schooling. And we're sitting with that educational aftermath, poor self-esteem, learning disorders. And a lot of that is just, I've missed 2 years of my schooling, and then the repercussions of that on mental health. So I'm really concerned about the still rising impact on mental health disorders in the aftermath of COVID, more so than really the physical aftermath maybe at this stage.
Are there other healthcare threats or health threats of the same magnitude lurking in the crevices of God knows where? I remember a conversation about the fact that there are bacteria now, or viruses, or some sort of micro organism that is now resistant to, I think it's the TB microorganism, that is now becoming more and more resistant to any of the medication that we have. Are there any other diseases that would have a similar kind of impact that COVID did 2 years ago on the globe? Are those conversations being had?
There is. Some of it is more maybe real threats. A lot of them is maybe conspiracies. A lot of them are maybe calculated scientific guesses. But it will really require a lot of factors to collaborate together to cause a pandemic again. Yet, it wasn't our first pandemic in human history, and it will certainly not be the last. there was the Black Death, Yersinia pestis, I can't remember all my timelines now.
Yeah.
There was HIV in the 80s that we thought, goodness, that will eradicate, I don't know how much of the population. And we pulled through. And the same with COVID. I mean, we were in complete panic, the whole globe, but yet we pulled through. So I think there's always threats. Perhaps at this stage, the threat of war is bigger if you look at international movements. Yeah. And I also believe the human race has the ability to bounce back. We will face challenges and we will overcome the challenges.
What about, Prof, what about issues of, the WHO came under a lot of fire during that COVID moment because of the sort of advice that it was giving the political world and so forth, giving the political world that made decisions to lock down economies and so forth. What is the status of World Health Administration? In other words, do organizations such as the WHO remain relevant? Do they still carry the respect that they should? Or are we beginning to see other arguments? And I ask this precisely because during the COVID-19 moment, there were big questions about whether or not to vaccinate. There were big questions around whether or not the vaccines that were approved to be taken globally were trial vaccines or had, and all of those sort of quasi-political conversations around the global administration of healthcare and so forth. Tell me about the status of the WHO and that aspect of world health.
I don't think there's any organization in this world that's perfect. I have a personal gripe with the WHO in terms of what is on their essential medicines list, because if you look at the essential drug list in South Africa, that is based on the EML of the World Health Organization. And if something like methylphenidate is not on it, then our government can say, but we don't have to provide it for children in the public sector. So the WHO do have implications for our public sector's decisions. So that's my personal gripe in terms of what is on the EML's essential list for mental health. However, I do think it's a well-functioning body, a well-coordinated body, and perhaps a good example of what works well, but not perfect. I do believe that they do make mistakes, as we all do. When we take a decision, we are basing it on the best information available to us at that given moment. And maybe retrospectively, we might criticize that decision or argue against the decision. The WHO still have the ability to respond and to coordinate care, but I think there is other local organizations that also have a strong voice and is way more agile in responding to crises as well than a bigger, more traditional body that have certain ways of operating. I'm trying to...
I can hear you. But I must
still have a balance between an academic and scientific opinion, based in science, and not my personal opinion.
I hear you. and right there it is the issue about World Health Day, isn't it? I mean, the issue of World Health Day is really to have conversations, as hard as they may be, about the implications of decisions that are made by less agile bodies on global health. And some may argue, Prof, and I understand the position that you find yourself in. Some may argue that it's perhaps not as easy as saying that, you know, people make mistakes, because the mistakes and the implications of the mistakes of large global health organizations are not ignorable. They're not small anyana mistakes. These are big mistakes that may have implications for global health. These are very, very powerful organizations funded by powerful people. Do we?
Yes and no. But let's look at the track record of the WHO.
Yeah.
If we have to give them some credit as well. They've eradicated smallpox. TB is virtually under control in most areas. We have a hot pocket of TB in South Africa, yes. Malaria, if we look at infant mortality rate, if we looked at the provision of assistance in war zones, I mean, there's a lot of good work that they do as well. But even the interview that we have tonight, you will know that I don't agree with everything they do. I disagree with the title of the theme this year, which they says, My Health, My Rights, because health is not a right. Health is a God-given blessing that we need to protect as well as a personal responsibility. Access to healthcare is the right. So I think I'm clear that I don't agree with everything that the WHO do, but in principle, they are a beneficent organization that aim to do good, and I think they're operating ethically, but not perfectly.
Yeah. All right. And I come back to South Africa and ask, how are we doing as South Africa in that space, in that global space, that global conversation? I mean, I know that not too long ago we almost didn't have our flag and the South African anthem sang at one of the most important sporting moments because we hadn't ratified our story as far as the process of investigating the drugs and the drug use and, in sport and so forth.
So do I think that our governing bodies make more mistakes than the WHO?
Not at all. No. The question is slightly more nuanced. The question is more, is South Africa a strong player in all of the debates that have to do with world health at this stage?
No, I think we're some of the most respected voices when it comes to HIV, when it comes to TB, and when it comes to COVID, due to our success stories locally here, and also due to corporate, private sector people that really change it around. If you remember back in the 80s when we were at the height of the AIDS pandemic, at that stage of AIDS era, where one, I don't want to say the name of the pharmaceutical company, but they actually contested international patent law to be able to bring generic products to fight the HIV/AIDS here locally with the antiretrovirals. And that was a landmark case internationally, and we were pioneers there. I think in terms of our huge success with the rollout of vaccines, we might now debate whether we should have vaccinated or not. I am pro-vaccination. I'm very grateful that I am fully vaccinated because I have comorbidities as well. And once again, there were certain reasons why we could get the vaccine. And once we had it, the rollout to the population was very, very effective. We also had a excellent example during the COVID pandemic where the private sector and parastatal sectors combined, and it was coming, I don't know if you're aware, but all the ventilators, the easy ventilators that was in mass production in South Africa was part of the I must remember what is the abbreviation, but the big multi-ray telescopes at Sutherland, I forgot now what the acronym is for it, but in any case, they were the people that was contracted to help to design and build. It was a bunch of engineers that then design and build and roll out the ventilators, which that was why the death rate in Europe was so extremely high, because they didn't have ventilators where we could quickly mass produce. And that is an excellent example of what worked. I'm just thinking of statistics about what we've achieved, where I Google the stats very, very often because I'm lecturing and giving talks and things. But every year when I look at our life expectancy in South Africa, it is improving. Yes, it's maybe not where the USA are, but we are significantly better than the rest of Africa. If we look at how the neonatal mortality rate has declined, yes, it's not like where the USA are yet, but we are much better than most of the other African countries, and it's improving year on year on year. Also the under 5 mortality rate. So we are doing things right as well, but there is room for improvement.
Final question, Prof. One of the big conversations in countries like South Africa, China, is the issue of traditional medicine, right? What is the status of traditional medicine in the global conversation? You know, and I'm talking here because there is, of course, the idea that we need to start having greater conversations that are collaborative, that are, and I see that that's happening, that, you know, medical practitioners are starting to talk to each other, They're starting to talk to the traditional medicine sort of space. But what are the paradigms? What's the thinking around traditional medicine globally?
So globally, there is more and more recognition of cultural, nuances in health. I think there is systems that's very much respected. If you look at Ayurvedic medicine, for example, that even though it's not widely practiced in South Africa, there's a lot of respect from Western type of practitioners as well. The traditional healers in South Africa is starting to fill this space and taking up the space, and they are included in conversations in terms of healthcare reform as well. Especially in mental health, where we train traditional doctors also to recognize when, for example, it is Amafufunyan and when it's Ukutwasa, you know, when it's culturally accepted call by the ancestors, or whether it is real psychiatric illness and when to refer. Yep. But we are concerned, like this weekend, there was a front page article in one of the newspapers in terms of also the use of psychedelics by traditional healers. Now, you know, certain psychedelics are still illegal in South Africa. Some others, it's more culturally nuanced, are acceptable. But I do think there's room for improvement. But traditional healers can be for us at the front line, especially in more rural areas. I just want to make one comment, if you will allow me.
Sure.
Saying that South Africa has made great strides. Yes, we have a lot of problems as well. But coming back to my whole argument of maybe we should not just focus on trying to get a national health insurance. More money is not going to solve the problem. There's another recent survey where they looked at the healthcare system efficiency. And South Africa was ranked last amongst 19 nations in this survey. And this survey of 33,000 ordinary people, private and public sector and healthcare professionals, how they viewed healthcare in our country. And they then found that the index showed that South Africa's efficiency was the lowest. And that means that technically, also if you look at our health budget per capita is good, but we're not using our resources judiciously. And therefore, if we can just keep that resources for the sick, and we can take personal responsibility to have healthy lifestyles, to avoid substances, to be active, not to be addicted to screen time, all of those things, and we can keep ourselves and our families healthy, we will need support. We will need multi-system reform. As I mentioned, poverty, education, all of those things that need to be addressed, the social determinants of health. I believe that we will get nearer to having a healthy nation than what we will get by viewing health as a right.
Professor Renata Skuman, it's been a great conversation. Thank you so much for a very wide-ranging conversation around world health and, of course, all of the issues that are pertinent to our situation here in South Africa. Thank you so much for joining us.